I'm speaking today with Dr. Kim Knowlton. She is the senior scientist on the Natural Resources Defense Council's Global Warming and Health Project. She's a co-author of the Human Health chapter of the White House's third National Climate Assessment Report, which was released last Tuesday. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, Dr. Knowlton.
Thanks, Ellie. It's great to be here.
Now, President Barack Obama released this climate change report last week. Can you give us a bit of background about it?
Sure. I'd be happy to. I was happy to be one of the co-authors on the Human Health chapter, as you mentioned, of this report, the third National Climate Assessment Report. It's the most comprehensive report on climate change to date, and it really zooms in on the U.S., the United States, and how climate change is affecting us right now. That's a big finding of the report. It's here and now, climate change. And it also looks to the future to see what climate change means for our future in very specific regions, kind of takes that information in a way that's not been done before and makes it hopefully very useful and applicable and has information in the report that will have interest for everyone. It's written in ways that all of us can understand, talk about with one another, and start to think about where we go from here, the kind of decisions we want to make about the future that we create.
Now, the method of the report's creation and its dissemination both seemed very strategic. One, I know the president spoke about it with a group of meteorologists, and I also noted that throughout the report, there were many statements made that had up to anywhere from 5 to even 15 citations. So the science, you could tell the efforts being made were very deliberate here.
That's true. It's a scientific report, and which we hope provides a foundation for informed decision-making. But you're absolutely right. There has been so much research, scholarship, new knowledge since the last report about the effects of climate change that the people working on the assessment, myself included, really made an effort to put the links, the citation, so that everyone could go and look at the background, because it's affecting us everywhere, no matter where we live in the country, and it's great, I think, very useful to have those links to dig in a little bit further and see what's happening where we live.
Now, obviously, really grounding this in science is an opportunity for the president or for anyone who wants to talk about global climate change to kind of face the opponents and to say, well, wait a minute, this is hard science. I would like to just read a comment from one of the opponents, less than positive responses, shall we say, from fossil energy groups, conservative think tanks, Republican senators, talked about this specific report being, quote unquote, alarmist. There was a quote, I believe, in the Washington Post from Senator Republican leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, who said that Obama was likely to, quote, use the platform to renew his call for a national energy tax, and I'm sure he'll get loud cheers from liberal elite, from the kind of people who leave a giant carbon footprint and then lecture everyone else about low-flow toilets. So it does seem that we're needing to have science here for people who, regardless of what the science says, will try to find a way not to talk about the imperative of global climate change.
A few thoughts come to mind. For one thing, climate change, it's not a partisan issue. It's affecting all of us today where we live. And when we get to talking about the public health effects, that's where the whole set of issues become very personal. It used to be other people that climate change happened to, but now it's happening to us. And the report was written very mindfully, very consciously to not be prescriptive of any particular policy, so it's really not written as a political document. It's a scientific document, very carefully put together, that assesses, evaluates, and then interprets that enormous and growing body of science for all of us, so we can all essentially participate in looking at and understanding better what's happening across the country and think about where we go from here. Look, there were people on the panel of scientists and experts, 300 people, from oil companies, from chemical companies, from the insurance industry, as well as universities, non-governmental organizations. It was written by the people, for the people. All kinds of people took part in this, and we were accepted and responded to comments from hundreds of the people, the public and agencies and government agencies. So it was really very equitably and fair-mindedly written to be usable for everyone.
And I'll say for anybody who hasn't yet taken a look at the document, it is an 840-page document, but online it's incredibly user-friendly, www.globalchange.gov. And you can go through and look at it, as you say, it's separated by regions, it's also separated by particular impact. And I know that, Dr. Knowlton, you work with the Health and Environment Program to talk about the impacts of global warming. Can you talk about some of your specific knowledge around the health impacts of climate change?
Sure, I'd be happy to. As we were saying before, public health is where climate change becomes really personal. It's happening across this country now to communities everywhere, to us. It's basically come into our backyard. I'll mention a few ways, because there's a number of different ways that climate change is affecting public health. And so I'll just, you know, give a survey before we dig in a little bit more in anything that particularly interests you. And several of these apply to the Southwest. Climate change is fueling more extreme weather events, like the kind of extreme heat and heat waves that we've seen in recent years. That has very direct effects and harmful effects on people's health. That extreme heat is also intensifying the effects of drought, of wildfires that I know pose enormous risks in New Mexico and the Southwest. Climate change is fueling more heavy downpours, sort of at the other end of the water spectrum, the kind of downpours that when they happen, flooding is a real problem, both in rivers and streams around the country, and then coastal flooding. Sea level rise is a real issue, and climate change is driving the biggest part of the rapid sea level rise we see around the country. Sea levels have risen about 8 inches in the last 100 years, but they're projected to rise another 1 to 4 feet this century in our children's lifetimes with climate change. A couple more I'll mention that are really quite important for health, which I care deeply about, is air pollution. Those rising temperatures make air pollution worse. We know that that has effect on millions of people in the country with asthma. There's about 26 million people among us who have asthma. I bet you everyone knows someone who struggles with asthma. And higher air pollution and pollen can make an asthma attack happen to one of the people that we know and care about. Well, climate change is making air pollution worse and make plants produce more pollen. So that's a real concern to all of us who know or care about people with asthma. The last one I'll mention, although there's others, are the kind of diseases that are transmitted by insects, by water, by food, as temperatures rise and rainfall patterns change. So there's a lot of ways, looking across the country, that climate change is affecting health. And in the end, that's really a risk to people's not only economic well-being, but our overall well-being. People's mental health is really starting to suffer in places and communities where there's extreme weather event after heat wave, after power outage because too many people are using the air conditioner, then a drought. It's really becoming the kind of public health problem, set of problems, we need to talk about, like, how are we going to make this better? And that's the good news. There's lots of opportunities that the assessment report points to for reducing climate change and preparing for the effects that we're seeing already.
Well, we're still on mental health. I thought it was, or health generally, I thought it was really interesting about mental health and how it is increasing stress-related disorders. We spoke about the higher, it's much higher after natural disasters, and Lord knows we're having more and more of that. Some people with mental illnesses are especially vulnerable to heat, it said in the report. I didn't know that. Suicide rates vary with weather. Dementia, a risk factor. Can you talk about some of those that may not be as obvious as something as pollution, as or an incredible increase in allergies?
There's starting to be a lot of concern and more research, scholarship, studies that look at this because, I mean, mental health is a concern for all of us. It's really a big part of overall well-being. But when we think about climate change and all of those extreme events you mentioned, heat waves, wildfire, drought, storms, coastal storms, notably two events come to mind. Hurricane Katrina in the Gulf, Hurricane Sandy that hit so much of the East Coast.
Yeah.
People's mental health, having to deal with, cope with, respond to, get back on their feet after those events, and event after event it has an effect on people's mental health, well-being, as well as our pocketbooks. We're all struggling to, you know, be on our feet economically, and I'm very concerned that these repeated weather events being fueled by climate change, even for strong, resilient people, which we all are, you know, proud of being who we are and helping others in times of need, it's going to start to take a toll on our resources. So we really need to prepare and do what we can to reduce the root cause of climate change.
Well, and it does seem that building resilience was the outcome. And I know we want to really talk about the impacts on the various areas, but also really emphasize the stress on resilience throughout all of these communities. That's where money needs to be invested. And it just seems that there's so many areas where that investment does need to be made. And the report is basically saying this will pay off. This is an investment that is worthwhile.
That's true. The report details how the cost of inaction, of doing nothing to prepare for these kind of events, can be 4 to 10 times greater than the cost of investing in preparedness before the fact. But the report provides a lot of information like that, again, as a foundation for decisions about where we go next. It doesn't lay, you know, it doesn't prescribe this is how America should proceed. And hopefully that's part of what makes this a conversation in which everyone can participate.
Let's talk a little bit about specifically what climate change means for New Mexico and the Southwest. And I know you've done some work on Southwest as well and drought conditions. Can you talk about that?
In the last few years, as we know, so much of the country, 60% of the country, was gripped by a historic drought in 2012. And then last year it continued. Drought is made worse, intensified by the kind of extreme heat that the Southwest and much of the country is seeing as well. That drought can affect people's health directly in harmful ways, a number of ways. When it's dry, the dust and what's carried in soil can blow downwind, sometimes long distances. That's dust, that's fine particles, that can be pollen, things that make it hard for people with respiratory illnesses to get a breath of air. Those particles can go deeply into people's lungs and be really harmful. Everything from those kind of particles and dust to some infectious agents that are really, you know, an enormous concern in the Southwest. Then there's wildfire. I mean, that's such a big concern and reality in the Southwest in New Mexico. Fire seasons have been terrible in recent years, and as climate change continues, that deepening water shortages, deepening drought, and rising heat is going to compound the risks of wildfires. About 10% of counties today are in higher extreme risk of water shortages nationwide, but that's projected to increase to basically a third of the counties in the country by 2050 as climate change continues. So when it comes to water, probably the hugest concern for the Southwest, there's the combined heat, drought, and wildfire sort of set of issues.
And they talk about in the Southwest, affecting 56 million people, a population expected to increase to 94 million by 2050.
Yeah. The Southwest is growing so rapidly. It's a tremendously high rate of population growth. I mean, it's beautiful. It's absolutely gorgeous. I'm very, very fond of New Mexico and the Southwest. And I have family and friends there, so I care a lot about this region. But most of the people in the Southwest, certainly not all, but most live in cities. And since the Southwest is the hottest and driest region of the whole country, that heat really contributes to some pretty significant urban heat island effects, as it's called, in a lot of the Southwestern cities. What that means is the strength, the intensity of the desert and the Southwestern sun. It's a great resource, but also it can make the building materials, the pavement, sort of the hard stuff that a city's built of, trap that heat, hold that heat during the day, and re-radiate it at night, especially because it's sometimes a challenge to, you know, have lush plantings, vegetation that's helping provide shade in cities in the Southwest it can actually make cities notably, measurably hotter than the surrounding countryside. And that's a health issue, to have millions of people of the Southwest in heat islands, as they're called, that are hotter than they should be otherwise. And it makes it harder for people who are vulnerable to the heat to, you know, stay healthy and have a sense of well-being in the summer.
And just mentioning trees and shade, I mean, one of the impacts is on ecosystems. Bark beetles have infested extensive areas of the western United States. Lord knows here in New Mexico, we see it everywhere. It's impacting all of our trees and leading to even more drought and drier weathers. There's also a mention here about tribes. The Southwest's 182 federally recognized tribes and communities are particularly vulnerable. Can you speak to that?
Sure. Tribes face things like loss of water resources on which they depend so deeply. So they're so connected to the land and to the resources that are provided by the land. So when stream flow is low, that affects traditional food sources, that affects water supplies, that affects drought locally and those high temperatures for people that may not prefer. There's many of us who may not prefer to use air conditioning. It makes it especially hard for people who spend a great deal of time outdoors. Also, tribes are facing like the change in snowpack. Less precipitation falls as snow now, and it's falling at a time when it is not ideal for agriculture. This affects, you know, people everywhere in the Southwest. But by the time it's the hottest part of summer and we really need those water supplies to provide water for agriculture, for drinking, they're gone. That lower snow melt has already melted, and that can be really hard on indigenous people in the Southwest.
And just poverty as well. I mean, New Mexico, Lord knows, faces an immense amount of poverty. We're one of the poorest states in the nation.
Yeah.
Also, tribes, it says, may face the loss of traditional foods, medicines, water supplies, as you mentioned, due to snowpack. And we also notice here that with changing climate, and this has been going on for years, that we have these early springs and then snows come and kill all of it. So agriculture is certainly being hit in terms of fruiting trees, in terms of large agricultural land, and we simply do not have the water. We're all fighting over, or farmers are, who's going to have access to any of the runoff of the Rio Grande?
Yes, absolutely. Those conflicts about water and water resources are nationwide going to be a major concern, but especially for you in the Southwest, an enormous concern. It's actually projected that by later this century, the 2080s, that an equivalent amount of snow, say you have a bucket of snow today, a bucket of snow in that future, the snow is going to contain far less water. It will be less dense. Even the snow, when it falls, will be of a different quality, such that we're all potentially, depending on the choices we make now, going to be in a tougher spot to have water that we can equitably share for the needs that we need, to provide to cities and people in rural parts of the Southwest.
And meanwhile, in other areas in the country, they have torrential downpours and rains. I always wondered if we're building pipelines at all, why aren't we doing this around water? It seems a much more valuable resource at this point.
That's a great idea. I love that idea. The Northeast, where I'm from, I grew up in upstate New York, and in the Northeast, those heavy downpours, the amount of rain contained in them has increased 71%. 71. That's a lot in the last 50 years. The hospital in upstate New York, where I was born, in Binghamton, New York, you know, not too big a city, but a nice city, the hospital where I was born was flooded in 2006 to its first floor. The hospital had to be evacuated because river waters just rose up and up and up and into the hospital, which is a, you know, foundational resource for health and security in that big community. And those kind of downpours, those extreme rainfall events, are projected to increase fivefold in our children's lifetime. So there are areas of concern, and I think that this is a great opportunity moment that we are talking to each other right now, for sure, Zaylee, but as a nation, that we're talking about and looking at the science, the nonpartisan science, to have informed discussions with each other about what do we want to do from here. Where do we go? How do we build healthier, more secure communities for the future?
I think that is why I get so frustrated by some of these kind of reactions that are not dealing with it. I feel like this is a much too important an issue to start being partisan about. This is impacting all of us, and we cannot move forward. But one of the aspects here as well, in terms of things we can do to mitigate it, we talk about cutting carbon pollution in New Mexico, investing in clean energy. And opponents may feel like this is, as our senator said, you know, a way to increase taxes on fossil fuels. And how can we have this conversation in a way that says, actually, we need to cut these things because it impacts all of us? We need to start investing in clean energy, not because it's about elitist cares, but because this is impacting our environment.
Because we all want to live in healthy, secure communities and make them a legacy for our children and grandchildren. I think that, I mean, that's hopefully the baseline on which all of us, you know, exist and talk to one another, which is really important. And to make those kind of communities, people want jobs that are secure, that are going to last a lifetime. If we want to talk a little bit about some of those policy options, it's really important for me to say that, you know, I'm not talking on behalf of the report or all the authors of the report or the government. I'm an author, and I'm so happy to be in that role. It was such a fantastic experience. But if we're going to talk about some of the very exciting policy ways we could go, I'm going to put on another hat. I'm going to take off my author hat, and I'm going to put on my Kim Knowlton, senior scientist at the Natural Resources Defense Council hat, just to be clear. As we mentioned that, as you were saying, there are many plans, ways we can go to use cleaner energy that won't run out, that's non-polluting. And when you do the cost calculation and you include some of the health costs that we will have to take account of because people's health is being harmed by the ways that we get energy, then it really makes sense to move toward those less polluting sources and step back from fossil fuel use. The economics show that it's a win, that we can actually have more in health benefits than we have to pay to make those changes.
Investing in clean energy, it says improving efficiency also. Obviously, using less energy to power our homes, businesses is critical. This, obviously, we know on an individual level, and certainly here in New Mexico and certainly here in Santa Fe, northern New Mexico, we talk so much about this. But I guess I get frustrated sometimes about the responsibility being put on individuals. In New York, they're talking about maybe don't ask for too much water at restaurants or whatever the most recent thing is. Is that really reasonable that individuals should maybe, you know, forego a glass of water while, you know, very wealthy people or anyone is not fixing the leak in their home here, wasting tens of thousands of gallons of water a month? How can we make this larger than the individuals riding their bike instead of the car? And again, of course, that's important.
Well, as you say, large reductions, large in emissions nationally and globally, could avoid some of these damaging effects of climate change in the future. That is super important. When we reduce carbon pollution, which is coming from, you know, the way we make choices about energy, when we burn fossil fuels, we put into the atmosphere air pollutants that hurt people's health today. We get a benefit for health right now, today, for ourselves when we produce less of that pollution. We make cleaner air. We get a double benefit because we produce less heat-trapping carbon pollution and scale back on the worst effects of climate change for the future, for our kids, for our grandkids. That's a double win. If we also replace, you know, our short car trips to go to the store or school or our businesses with walking and biking and more public transit, we get more exercise, and that is enormously powerful for people's health and well-being. And those kind of changes, which are, you know, community and national level and state level, states are doing really important things, they all make a difference. There's, on every level, we cannot afford to delay another decade to make really critical decisions about making significant changes. If we do that, we're just kicking the climate change can down the road. But it's almost like with every kick, it gets heavier, it gets harder to kick, and we're leaving the whole issue behind for our children to solve. And that's not fair. It's not wise, because it's going to cost more to make these changes and protect our health as time goes on.
This is Zaylee sitting in for Mary Charlotte. We're going to take a quick break. Welcome back to the Radio Cafe. This is Zaylee Pollan sitting in for Mary Charlotte. I am here with Kim Knowlton, NRDC Senior Scientist. Let's talk about some of the recommendations that were made here, and the number one, or the first one, and you can put back on the author hat of the report. This comes from the report specifically. And the first one is informing yourself. So you had mentioned that. The second one, make changes at home. This is a little bit what I was talking about. You know, change your light bulbs, insulate your home. Okay. Number three, be greener at the office. Plenty of things you can do. Reduce emissions in transit. Get involved and educate others about the big picture. So a lot of this, again, use Energy Star equipment, recycle. The conversation we're not having is also what you're referring to. It's this much larger conversation. Are we going to start having that with this?
That's one of the choices that we face. That's probably, in my opinion, in my mind, that's the choice we face, is are we going to use the report? Hopefully people will read it, like go to your region, go to a sector, like there's issue topic chapters in the report. Health is one of them, energy is one, water is one, agriculture. Read about what you care about and then have more conversations that aim toward that decision making, because look, these decisions are in our hands. We are powerful. We have the power to, you know, say this is our choice. This is what we want. So it's my hope that the information, the science, the foundational information here, written for everyone, people will use to move, to get together and move bigger cities and counties and states and our country toward, you know, building that more equitable, sustainable future that's healthy for everyone. I think that that's enormously important, but we do it with information and we do it with one another. It's to be, as people have said, it's the power of the people to say, this is what we want, this is our choice.
I'm speaking today with Dr. Kim Knowlton. She's a senior scientist on the Natural Resources Defense Council's Global Warming and Health Project. She's also the co-author of the Human Health Chapter of the White House's third National Climate Assessment Report, which was released last Tuesday. Again, anyone can go online, www.globalchange.gov, to look through it. It's separated into different regions, different impact aspects. And Dr. Knowlton, were there any surprises for you in this? Obviously, this took a long time and a lot of research. You've been steeped in a lot of this language for years and years, I would assume. Were there surprises?
I think, well, a couple of things. As we, on the health chapter that I worked on, and then with the larger team of the scientists and experts that put together the 30 chapters, as we started to do that integration of the science and the evidence that's out there, the fact that climate change is having effects here and now today, that to me is one of the biggest aspects of what's new of this report. In the United States, it's happening in our backyards. And this report is uniquely about the United States. It's different in that way from the Intergovernmental Panel Changes Report, Panel on Climate Changes report that people may have heard about recently. It's also more detailed, this report, than other reports. It really looks at that regional level. And the extent of the choices that we have to make and the effects that we stand to go this way or that way, like the fork in the road that we're at, essentially, as we talk about a lower emissions, lower carbon emission versus a higher carbon emission future, were striking to me. And one example, if we, you know, talk with one another and do our, you know, talking with people that are making decisions and move toward burning less fossil fuel, a lower carbon future, if you want to call it that, then temperatures in the U.S. as a whole could increase about 2 to 4 degrees by the end of this century. They've already increased 2 degrees Fahrenheit in the last century. So we're still going to have to prepare and adapt, and there's a lot of cities and states doing great stuff in that area. But on the flip side, if we do nothing, think talking again about the cost of doing nothing, and just proceeding as we always have, same sort of energy choices in what we do, the country, the nation as a whole, could increase in its average annual temperature 8 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit. That's a lot more. And while it might not sound like, you know, it makes a world of difference outside, if you think about it, a day that's 8 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit hotter, in terms of the annual average, it makes an enormous difference. It's like those annual average temperatures are like your body temperature. You think about, it's an index of your overall health and well-being. So that amount of temperature increase, I think, frankly, would be challenging for us to adapt to. Of course, we will try. Everyone will make their best efforts, undoubtedly. We're Americans. We don't go the easy route. We go towards what needs to be done. But still, we face some challenges, and it makes sense to create decisions about challenges that we can face successfully and move towards health.
I think I also appreciated the relationships that I seemed to find when I went through the website on this. For example, talking about water supply generally, the message, you know, options for reducing emissions and climate vulnerability. There were the dependence of energy systems on land and water supplies. Again, in areas like the Southwest, energy is important everywhere, obviously. Water is incredibly vital, but that these are intrinsically linked. And if we don't start linking these, then I think the message is lost. And it, of course, was not lost on many people that the president gave this announcement to a group of meteorologists who had been talking about extreme weather, the 100-year flood, ongoing for years now, instead of saying climate change is actually causing this. Is that an important place to start?
Yes, I think both are. One, the interconnections that you mentioned are entirely important, like water is connected to energy use, is connected to land use, and that's brought forward in this report, in this assessment report, as never before. There's connection between urban infrastructure, meaning the buildings, the roadways, the bridges, the sort of material, the built environment that we create to help our cities, our communities go, between that and transportation and energy use. So that's true. Those connections have been made as never before in this report. At the same time, it's important to consider and ask ourselves about those kind of interconnections and when they are challenged too far, when there are those multiple systems failures, if you want to think of them that way, as we saw in Hurricane Katrina, enormous storm of great force, hit a city, power went out, transportation systems were then challenged. People couldn't get out of harm's way. It was also very hot at the time. There was no air conditioning. There was no drinking water that could be supplied to people who needed it most. Multiple systems failed, and people's health really suffered. As we know, people lost their lives, and it has long-term repercussions. So it gives us a chance to think about our very important systems that keep us healthy and protected, and how we can protect them in the future when climate change challenges so many of those systems.
I want to take you back to resilience one more time here, specifically in health, because we're talking about an uptick even in allergies, asthma, other mental health illnesses. So when we talk about resilience, what does that mean logistically, all the way from health to something like New York, where they're expecting water levels to raise 2 feet? What is a practical application of building resilience there?
Yes, I think that one dimension of it is that people who are already struggling to stay healthy are going to see their problems intensify with a lot of these climate change effects. But I'm thinking of people 65 years of age and older, and children, and people with lung and heart illnesses today. People, as you mentioned before, who are economically disadvantaged, some communities of color, indigenous people, people who are already, you know, working to stay healthy, all of these effects that climate change is feeling is going to challenge them more. And that's millions of us. The numbers of people 65 and older is growing at the most rapid rate in a century right now. So resilience, one dimension, I think, is being mindful of the great number of people among us who are especially vulnerable, knowing where they are when something happens, when a storm is approaching or a heat wave is predicted, and creating early warning systems, as a lot of cities have done. Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, one example. They have put together a terrific heat health early warning system because they had some really terrible heat waves back in the early 90s that in which people unfortunately died. A lot of people got sick, some people died. The city put together then an early warning system that knew where the people, the older people in the community lived, made buddy system teams like block captains to reach out to those people, got the National Weather Service and the Office of the Aging together, all of the media, so you reach out to the people who we know will be most at risk. And I mean, that's one dimension of resilience. And then the other side, I think, are the double benefits that we talked about before. Ways that we can reduce the use of fossil fuels, but at the same time, get the air pollution benefit today, get a, you know, more physical activity benefit today, and reduce heat-trapping carbon pollution that's going to, you know, avoid those kind of climate change damages and effects in the future. That's resilience, too. Those are cities that won't be as compromised or face as many effects when those climate change effects do happen. That's another dimension of preparedness. And the assessment report has a whole chapter on adaptation that I invite people to read and find out more about the specific steps that cities and states all around the country are taking on preparedness.
And again, there's kind of interactive maps where you push with adaptation. This is what the country will look like without it. Here is where it could, all hypothetical, of course. It says, you know, in New York State, 2 feet of sea level rise is estimated absent adaptation investment to flood or to render unusable miles of roads. So is this a decision now that is up to New York State, whether or not it will specifically invest in the adaptation investment? Will this be federally subsidized? Whose plate is it on right now to do that?
Mm-hmm. It's a great question, and I'm sure that there could be many players in this, whether it's at the city, at the state, at the county, at the federal level. I mean, all of those different levels of decision-making come into play. But I think that what's important here is that you've just, by looking at the report, and I'm very excited about this, seeing something that's happening and asking, okay, now who do we need to get together at the table to make the decisions and the next set of changes? That's exactly, I think, what the inspiration of the report is, to lay out the science, lay out the evidence, and show the opportunities for people talking about how the heck do we make this problem better? Because we can. We're going to become more prepared. We can. I mean, the thing that we can't model, that we're not good at modeling, we're pretty good at modeling temperature and rainfall now. And there's, you know, tremendously great science about that. But we're still not good at modeling the human spirit and the spirit to participate, to make good things happen, to get involved, to say, we want to make a healthier and more secure future ours. That's, I think, the missing piece that's huge in this whole picture.
And as you say, this early warning system, building community. I mean, really, that seems to be a lot of what we're losing in this internet age. And yet it's very basic, isn't it? Check on your neighbor. Make sure that person is okay. You know, be prepared for it. Communicate. See who needs what. I think that this could be really a good call for people to come together and be aware of who's in the community and be aware of what's happening and how you can help. It does seem that that interconnectedness, that building of community, is something very basic. It's a basic fabric that people are going to need. They're going to need to be resilient.
You're absolutely right. You're actually giving me shivers as I hear you say that, because it's so true and there's poetry in it, what you just said, but it's reality. It's a human reality. We need each other. We need to protect each other and our communities, and to leave a better place for our kids and their grandkids. It's the tradition of, you know, act now for seven generations. It's the Native American. It's the indigenous people's way. It's that wisdom, but it really makes sense in terms of dollars, if you want to put it in that dimension, and it makes sense in terms of the sense of wanting to create those secure futures for ourselves. I mean, that's the America that I want to live in, and I think that everyone else does as well. So it's going to be exciting to see what kind of opportunities communities and states take, hopefully using the report as sort of the seeds for more discussion and action.
Well, I know here in Santa Fe, we're gonna start talking about our own climate adaptation report. I'm wondering, Dr. Knowlton, if you have, this has been out just about a week by the time we go on air, what kind of response have you heard and what kind of conversations have started within your groups?
The report, which launched on Tuesday, the 6th of May, had a very successful launch, and there was a lot of interest from the press, nationally, internationally. There's a whole network called NCA, NCA standing for the National Climate Assessment, NCA Net, which you can see who are the groups, the people who are members of NCA Net, to which everyone is, you know, welcome to join. It's on the globalchange.gov site that you mentioned. It's a very exciting network of people who are taking the next steps to have more conversations and webinars and meetings about how the assessment report applies to their lives and how they want to take it and sort of keep the ball rolling. So there's more and more activities just in the, you know, this first week that are being planned by the great groups and people in NCA Net. And I think, you know, starting these conversations, like the opportunity I am having right now to speak with you and your listeners, is fantastic. This is it. This is what puts us all, you know, around the table together to talk about these opportunities and how we're going to go at this fork in the road. How are we going to proceed?
I've been speaking with Dr. Kim Knowlton, senior scientist on the Natural Resources Defense Council's Global Warming and Health Project. She's also the author of the Human Health Chapter of the White House's third National Climate Assessment Report, which was released last Tuesday. We encourage everyone to go to the website, www.globalchange.gov. Read it. Check it out. Find out what is happening in your region. In the Southwest here, we have a lot of things to deal with. We have some scary realities in terms of drought, in terms of fire, in terms of insect infestation, and grappling with questions around clean energy. This is huge here in New Mexico. We have a lot of natural gas and we have very little water. And how are we going to weigh the interests that people have? So obviously, it's a very big conversation. It certainly isn't just beginning, but it needs to get more serious. As this project or as this report shows, climate change is impacting us right now. Is there anything else, Dr. Knowlton, you would like to tell our listeners about, either about your experience with the report or what we should be paying attention to as we go down the road?
Well, it was an honor to be a part of the drafting, the writing of the report. I learned a lot, and I'm very excited about the conversations that, not only the one that you and I are having, but the conversations that are already starting to take place. And to remind that this report is really about, yes, some evidence about what's happening today and will happen tomorrow in our backyards. That's fairly sobering, but to remember we have opportunities. This all ends up with the opportunities we have to make choices about moving forward into a future that we can be proud to leave our children and grandchildren. And we can absolutely get there, but it's going to take us acting and thinking and talking right now.
And for any naysayers who still question whether climate change is happening or if it might be man-made, and I don't know, does that come up in the report?
It does not come up in the report because the agreement among the scientific community is rock solid. Based on the evidence, more than 97% of climate scientists conclude that human-caused climate change is happening. Human activities are the primary cause. 97% consensus agreement. I don't know 97% of bread bakers or school teachers or moms or dog walkers who can agree on anything. So that is like a rock. No, it's mentioned, but it doesn't have to be discussed further.
So anyone who still wants to deny this connection, what do you have to say to these people?
The science is solid as a rock, and it's available in the report for you to look at and consider. Also, the website has really good graphics that show the evidence that the scientific community has looked at to come up with a 97% agreement that hopefully will be compelling and of interest. And you know, the science speaks. We understand the chemistry and physics of the atmosphere and the oceans, and I invite people to enjoy the science because it speaks with a unified voice.
Dr. Kim Knowlton, thank you so much for being with us today on the Radio Cafe. I really appreciate your time and your explanations about this big report that just came out.
It's my pleasure, Zaylee. It's been great to be here. Thanks a lot.
Perhaps we'll have to check in down the line and see what responses are as we go down the road with it.
I'd be happy to.
Wonderful. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Zaylee, sitting in for Mary Charlotte.